The link between organized crime and the American way.
Well, it has to do with American capitalism. I mean, you ask any mobster, gangster, and I've interviewed quite a few of them in all different ethnicities. Ask them what they do for a living, and they'll tell you they're a businessman. The ruthless tactics of American enterprise. This is rooted very deeply in the American story. I would say, ask yourself why this type of organized crime and this mentality that makes organized crime possible has been so persistent in American history and continues to this day.
That's TJ English. We talk with him about his epic story of the Cuban-American underworld and what it tells us about the American political economy. It's called The Corporation. We also air a clip from our 2008 interview with TJ English about his book, Havana Nocturne. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. While the Italian mafia was the original driving force in creating the criminal underworld in the U.S., by the mid-1980s, that world had become much more ethnically diverse. One of the most powerful illicit organizations was the Cuban mob. Known on both sides of the law as the Corporation, the Cuban mob's power stemmed from a criminal culture embedded in South Florida's exile community. Those who hoped to overthrow Fidel Castro's revolution and reclaim their nation for themselves. But on the way to that hoped-for outcome, they built a ruthless criminal empire in their land of exile. TJ English wrote about the American Mafia and the Cuban Revolution in his 2008 book, Havana Nocturne. Now, a decade later, he's returned with a kind of sequel, an epic story of the Cuban-American mob with its history of murder, mayhem, and corruption, and its connection to some of the highest levels of the U.S. government, including the CIA. TJ English is an author and journalist whose work chronicles the American underworld. He's the author of 8 books, including Savage City, Havana Nocturne, and now his latest, The Corporation. Welcome back to Writer's Voice, TJ English.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You know, the last time we spoke, it was about your book about the Cuban Revolution, Havana Nocturne. And I remember saying then to you, I think maybe it was after the interview, you know, you should write a book about the Cuban mob. And you were interested at that time. And now you have. You actually call this story about the post-revolutionary Cuban mafia in America a classic American story. Why is that?
Well, as you know, I've written a number of books over the years now about the organized crime process in America from the point of view of many different ethnicities. I've written 3 books on the Irish-American experience. I wrote a book about a Vietnamese gang that was a more recent contemporary book. I've written about this subject a lot, both contemporary and historical, and I've come to the conclusion that there's something very central to the American experience about this process of organized crime that individuals and ethnic groups go through in the United States. This was the Cuban version of it. It's a more recent historical story in the sense that it comes after the Cuban Revolution of 1959. Others that I've written about, traditional organized crime, Italian, Irish, Jewish, that goes back more than 100 years. But it's a remarkably similar story, this process of assimilation that involves criminality and gangsterism, particularly at the entry level to this society. And so I have come to the conclusion that there's something very central to the American story about this this process of organized crime.
You do root the story in the Cuban Revolution, And very much in the response of those people who became involved in the Cuban Mafia and their response to the Cuban Revolution. But what about the mob that was all over Cuba before the revolution? I mean, after all, your central character, his name is José Miguel Battle. He was involved, and he was a cop, but he was kind of a crooked cop and involved with the mafia before the revolution happened.
Yes, but I think he was a corrupt cop in Havana, a vice cop in the 50s, as were many cops, probably. I think I make the comment that being a vice cop in Havana in the 1950s was like being a member of the Centurion Guard during the time of Caligula. It was kind of a famous vice era in Havana in the 50s. And yes, José Miguel Battle rubbed elbows with Meyer Lansky and Santo Traficante and the American organized crime figures who were the big players in Havana throughout the 1950s. And so the contacts were made there in Havana in the 50s. And when the revolution occurred and Castro came into power and basically chased the mafia off the island and also exiled many Cubans who either were associated or affiliated with the previous government of Fulgencio Batista or were not sympathetic to the revolution, they were exiled to the United States. And it's that cauldron of like-minded interest, the mobsters that got chased out of Havana and the Cuban exiles who were chased out of Cuba, that formed the nucleus for this organized crime entity that became known as the Corporation. José Miguel Battle started this operation in the United States by utilizing those contacts that he had in the Italian mafia, and that's what made it possible.
Mm. What also made it possible was, in many ways, the CIA. Talk about the impact of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was where many of these folks first became acquainted with each other.
Yes, the whole first chapter of this book deals with the Bay of Pigs invasion from the point of view of José Miguel Battle, who was a member of the 2506 Brigade. For those who may not know or don't remember, a quick reminder, the Bay of Pigs invasion was undertaken by, well, initially the Eisenhower administration, but it was put into action reluctantly by the Kennedy administration. And it was an attempt to put together a covert secret invasion of Cuba using Cuban exiles, and they would invade the island and overthrow the Castro government and kill Fidel Castro and take back Cuba. That was the plan. And it was a disaster for everyone involved because Castro knew they were coming. He had information that they were coming and he was ready for them. And they were more or less slaughtered when they landed in Cuba. Many were killed, and those who weren't killed were imprisoned in Cuba and held for the next nearly 2 years before their release was negotiated by the Kennedy administration. This incident, the Bay of Pigs invasion, is such an important historical signpost, not only for the Cubans who were involved in it, but in terms of American policy towards Cuba. And the relationship between the CIA and the Cuban exiles and the Cold War, actually, the war between the United States and the Soviet Union, where Cuba became a piece on this chessboard, a very important piece. So all these geopolitical factors were put in motion in the wake of the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And that also was a sequence of events that had a tremendous impact on shaping this criminal organization, the Corporation.
And it wasn't just the Bay of Pigs. I mean, this was an association of, these Cuban exiles and the CIA, assassination attempts that happened not only on Fidel Castro but elsewhere. Talk about the longer relationship between, basically the Cuban mob and the CIA.
Yes, very important to this story. I mean, the Corporation basically was a racketeering enterprise created by Battle to make money. He was a gangster, a mobster, and the Corporation used betting the number, known as bolita in the Latino community, a highly profitable, popular gambling game of just simply betting on a three-digit number on a daily basis. And this formed the basis of Battle's criminal organization. But he never gave up the dream of killing Fidel Castro and taking back Cuba. This was the dream not only of Jose Miguel Battle, but of his generation, what I refer to in the book as the Bay of Pigs generation. Many men who had taken part in that invasion or were sympathetic to and fellow travelers of that movement. And even after the Bay of Pigs invasion, Kennedy administration initially did not give up plans to kill Castro and unseat Castro. And there was a secret CIA operation called Operation Mongoose that was devoted to the destabilization of Cuba and the overthrow of Castro. And this is has been documented. The CIA has declassified these documents. It took 30 or 35 years for them to do that. But we now know that these events took place, that the CIA was working hand in hand with certain high-ranking members of the mafia and with Cuban exiles in an attempt to do away with Fidel Castro. And this became an obsession of all of these parties involved that would continue for the next 40 years and affect the lives of many people, and also having a determining impact on American foreign policy towards Cuba and Latin America for the next 40 years. So that's what's so fascinating about the story of the corporation. It's not just the story of a criminal enterprise, although it is that, and a fascinating story, I would say, of a criminal enterprise. But it also had this political context that makes the story even more interesting and far more important in terms of the history involved.
Yes, and I wonder if you could comment on why do you think that the mafia and the Cuban mafia would be so interested in overthrowing Castro, and why the CIA would see its way to collaborating so closely with them?
Well, the Cuban Revolution and the ascension of Fidel Castro as a communist government right next door to the United States of America was something that, for lack of a better term, freaked out the U.S. government. They were very concerned about it, and the CIA was very concerned about it and felt it was their job to do away with this communist menace that was on our doorstep. And generations of American policymakers took up this mandate over the next 50 years or so, the latter part of the 20th century, this idea that the spreading, not only Castro, but the spreading of Castroism in Latin America was a great threat to the very existence of the United States of America. Now, that was the reason the CIA and the United States was involved. The reason the mafia and Cuban exiles were involved is they'd been humiliated by Fidel Castro. When Castro took power, he not only kicked them off the island, he seized all their properties. He unceremoniously seized all their holdings and kicked them out. And it was a process of humiliation that continued with the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, and they were held in prison and put through further humiliation. So the feelings they had about Fidel Castro entered the realm of the psychotic. I mean, they wanted revenge. That's very clearly what they wanted, was revenge. So it was this mixture of motivations that created a really toxic brew that existed in American politics. I mean, you can follow the thread from the Bay of Pigs invasion. You can follow a narrative thread of the CIA and certain factions in the U.S. political establishment using Cuban exiles, militant Cuban exiles, to do all kinds of dirty deeds on behalf of the U.S. government. The Watergate burglary, five of the seven plumbers, the burglars, were Cuban exiles. Four of them had been in the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Watergate burglary was put together by a CIA agent named E. Howard Hunt, who was one of the architects of the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Cuban exiles could be called on to do all kinds of dirty tricks, in the theory that, in fact, Hunt admits that he recruited the Cubans for the Watergate burglary by telling them, you do this burglary and then we go get Fidel. you do this action for us, and then we go get Fidel. And like attack dogs, the Cuban exiles could be called on to do all kinds of things because they had this dream that it was all leading to getting rid of Fidel Castro.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with T.J. English about his latest book, The Corporation. And before we leave this this point, talk about Luis Posada Carriles. He was involved with the assassination of Orlando Letelier, and I want to say that and also the assassination of Letelier's aide, Ronnie Moffitt. I actually was a friend of Michael Moffitt at the time. We were both students at the American University Political Economy PhD program, and I remember very well that assassination attempt. So to talk about that.
Well, that wasn't just an assassination attempt. They actually blew up his car right in Washington, D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue and murdered Letelier and the people who were in the car with him. Yes, I follow. Luis Posada Carriles was one of many exiles who joined the U.S. Army and was stationed in Fort Benning, Georgia, as was Jose Miguel Battle, a man named Felix Rodriguez, and many people who would go on to be leading lights of the anti-Castro movement and powerful in other ways, like Battle, who became a gangster. They all were CIA trained in the Bay of Pigs invasion. When they were stationed at Fort Benning, they were a special unit that had more CIA training. And out of that group of Cuban exiles grew many of the people who would become the most active in the anti-Castro movement. And Luis Posada Carriles is a legendary figure who was involved in various attempts to directly assassinate Fidel, and then also other operations that were designed to destabilize the Cuban government and bring down Fidel. You mentioned the car bombing of Letelier. There also was a bombing of a Cuban airliner that was flying from Panama City to Havana. 72 or 73 innocent people were blown out of the sky. This was terrorist activity that was being undertaken on behalf of the anti-Castro movement, if not fully sanctioned by the CIA, with the knowledge of the CIA. And this was considered appropriate activity in the time of the Cold War. All kinds of dirty things were being done in the interest of the Cold War. So I tell this story. It's almost a parallel narrative in the story of the corporation, because so many of these figures, Battle, Posada, these are people who crossed paths, who were fellow travelers. I think Battle was a little disappointed in his life that he became so consumed in the gangsterism side of things that he would like to have contributed more to the anti-Castro movement. They all felt very strongly that that was their calling in life, and had been ever since they were exiled from their homeland.
And now, this bombing of the Cuban airline actually led to a tremendous amount of dissension within the Cuban exile community, and they turned on themselves, began to use basically mob hits against dissenters within their community. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, there was an organization in Miami called Alpha 66, and there was another one in Union City, New Jersey, called Omega 7. These were basically Cuban exile terror organizations that were designed to do covert operations, bombings, assassinations, things like this. People who were trained in this kind of activity and could be called upon to do these things. And eventually there did develop quite a bit of dissension within the Cuban American community, also within the militant exile community, over tactics, over how far you could go. How far were you willing to go in the interest of getting rid of Fidel Castro? Was it morally acceptable to plant bombs in embassies, to assassinate leaders of organizations who you believed were contrary to your point of view, to take up what we would now quickly call terrorist activity on behalf of your goals? And there was a strong feelings on this within the Cuban American community, and it did turn inward. The more militant people in that movement you know, believed that some of the others weren't militant enough. And so a lot of the violence was along those lines. How far were you willing to go? And it was quite an ugly period, a dark period in American history, in Cuban-American history. I put all of this under the heading of the residue of the revolution. The revolution opened up the proverbial can of worms and had a lot of unforeseen consequences, both in Cuba and the United States. And it's certainly something that's had a huge impact on shaping the trajectory of a whole generation of Cuban Americans who came in the wake of the revolution.
Now, moving to the mafia's activity here, and you really center the book around Battle himself, and you really talk about him as having a fatal flaw. You know, as he modeled himself after the Godfather. He wanted to be called El Padrino, and he was called El Padrino, which is Godfather in Spanish. Talk about him as an individual and how he ran his organization and ultimately, in some ways, brought it down.
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. I think one of the more interesting mob boss characters in the history of the 20th century. He assumed the role of a mob boss very early on and really devoted himself to it when he came to the United States and started this criminal organization. He was very good at utilizing corruption to further his agenda. So he learned who to pay off and was more than willing to pay off political figures, law enforcement figures, anyone within the system that could help him. He was more than willing to pay them off. And so corruption was a big part of his operations. And also, he was smart to have formed this alliance with the Italian mafia and said to them, look, Bolita is going to be a huge moneymaker in the decades ahead as more and more Cubans flee Cuba and come to the United States. And a lot of them like to bet the number. It's a tradition deeply rooted in Latino culture, particularly Cuban culture. And he said to the mafia, if you let us organize this and set this up, it'll make us all rich, and you will get your piece of the pie. And that alliance held for quite a while until it didn't, and a war broke out between the Cubans and the Italians. But generally speaking, Battle was very good at establishing alliances and paying whatever needed to be paid and making sure everyone was sort of taken care of within this universe that he operated so that everyone was happy. And he had certain leadership qualities that you would have to call admirable qualities. He'd been a war hero in the Bay of Pigs invasion. He had done a truly heroic act. When I first heard that this was part of his legend, you know, I was a little bit skeptical. I thought, well, you know, a lot of people say they were war heroes. How can I verify this? And I spent a lot of time tracking down the men that he saved in this incident that I'd heard about, and I found also two of the men who went with him on that expedition to save fellow soldiers. And then I went to Cuba, to the Bay of Pigs, to the exact location where this incident occurred. So I was able to definitively verify that he was a legitimate war hero. And that became part of his reputation in the community. He was greatly revered by a lot of people for being a hero during the invasion. And so he had this kind of leadership aura about him. He assumed the role of leadership. Some people told me he wasn't a mastermind or anything like that. It wasn't that he was a genius or the brightest guy in the world, but he was a man of action who was willing to do things that he asked of others. And he had, as Latinos say, he had cojones, he had balls. He was a guy who was believed to have a kind of courage in situations that required it. So he had all of these characteristics, but he also had, you mentioned a character flaw. He probably had more than one, but certainly one that he had was this overweening desire for revenge. I think a lot of it came from the humiliation of the Bay of Pigs invasion And the Bay of Pigs invasion was an attempt at revenge against Fidel Castro, and it was thwarted, and it was put all these men through further humiliation. And I think that it had a psychological effect on many of them. And the idea of revenge, if you were wronged in some way, or if someone had made you look like a fool or made you look bad, this guy was going to get even with you, and he would calculate and spend years doing it if he had to get it done. And the book, of course, is full of all these epic revenge plots, mostly against people within the organization that had betrayed the organization or wronged Battle in some way, as he perceived it. And he would vow revenge, and he would carry it out, often to the detriment of the organization. And some of the other leaders in the organization saw this as a real problem. Jose Miguel Battle was the kind of guy who would resort to violence as a first resort, not as a last resort. He turned to violence. He was very brutal. And when it involved revenge, he was ruthless. And I think this ate away at the trust of various members of the organization. They feared Battle. They didn't so much respect him as fear him. And that ultimately did contribute to the fall of the organization.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with T.J. English about his latest book, The Corporation. This story also, it has amazing characters in it. It reads like a movie, and I know that we're going to look forward to a movie with Benicio del Toro. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The movie interest was there right from the beginning based on the book proposal. I think what people recognize is it truly is an epic story. It spans 40 or 45 years, and it's a generational story. It's almost like Godfather 1 and 2 together, with this added element of the political context, the aftermath of the revolution. So, yeah, it's a big story. Battle is a very charismatic character. There's a lot of characters in this story that are very memorable. There are a lot of acts of violence that are kind of outrageous and crazy, like some of the violence in the Godfather movies. So it was it seems like a natural. The interest is certainly there, and there are some big players involved.
Oh, that's terrific. And so one of those is, of course, the cop. This is a true story, and yet you have all the elements of a great fiction, of a great novel. You have David Shanks. He is the cop who nailed Battle eventually. I hope I'm not giving anything away on money laundering charges after 18 years. Tell us about him.
Yeah, David Shanks was a Miami police officer. He actually came into the story somewhat late in the story. I mean, the corporation had been up and running for close to 20 years by the time David Shanks becomes involved in the early 1980s. And so Battle had originally lived in Union City, New Jersey, which is a really fascinating community, with the second highest population of Cuban Americans after Miami. Not many people are aware of that Union City, New Jersey had become this enclave of Cuban Americans. Battle settled there. He started his Bolita operation from there. Most of the money was made in the five boroughs of New York City. That's where the money was made. Eventually, Battle moves to Miami in the mid-1980s. And this is when he comes on the radar of a local cop, David Shanks, who worked an organized crime unit. He dealt quite a bit with gambling charges and money laundering, both which were common practices of the corporation. So he started following Jose Miguel Battle, and he was having a hard time getting the interest of law enforcement involved in it, because by then the narcotics business had sort of exploded, especially in South Florida and Miami. It was the era of the cocaine cowboys and all of that. And there was so much outrageous violence and mayhem associated with the cocaine business that a lot of people in law enforcement just weren't willing to take this gambling thing seriously. But Shanks would say, look, this is more than just gambling. This guy is violent. There's a lot of murders associated with this organization. The profits that he's making are off the charts. He's laundering this money through a whole series of front corporations and offshore bank accounts. You know, this was a really significant, it evolved into a really significant operation. But Shanks was having a hard time bringing this to the attention of his bosses in law enforcement. And so it took a long time to make a big case against Battle and the corporation. Shanks stayed on this case for, as you said, 18 years. There were many little cases along the way that he was involved in. Battle was prosecuted and convicted a couple times for gun possession and gambling charges and a few things, but he would always get off on a technicality. He had a very skilled attorney, and he'd be back out on the street before you know it. And, of course, prison did not reform him. I mean, he was a professional criminal, and he did a lot of his criminal business from behind bars. And as soon as he got out, he was back into the life. And eventually, Shanks just stays on it until he does begin to sort of get the attention of higher-ups in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Federal law enforcement takes an interest, and they finally do get around to building a big RICO case, a racketeering case against the corporation. But that's not until, you know, the early 2000s. By then, Battle was an old man, and he was in bad health. He lived a long and fruitful life as a gangster.
And there was a fair amount of corruption of even judges. As you say, it only really was when the feds became involved that he could get nailed.
Yeah, he's, as I said, was a master at the well-placed payoff. Who needed to be paid off? What cop, what judge, what lawyer, what figure within the so-called upper world needs to be paid off for him to manipulate the system in such a way that he can get a favorable ruling for himself? Battle was very skilled at that. That was money well spent as far as he was concerned. And one of the, I think, sort of alarming things about this story and about so many organized crime stories that I've written is how vulnerable the system is to corruption. And there usually is some cog in the machine that can be bought off. And it's usually just some lowly person that needs the money for whatever reason. And they can be used and compromised into a situation where they are corrupted. And this is traditionally has been an aspect of organized crime in the United States going at least back to the Prohibition era. I mean, so much of what we know as organized crime today has its roots in Prohibition era. This is really when this relationship between the upper world and the underworld was created. Back then it had to do with booze, alcohol, legal alcohol, and all the money that was to be made by supplying this illegal product to a population that wanted it. Today it's narcotics. It's cocaine and heroin and marijuana and other drugs that people want to use and will pay for, and it puts the people who are able to deliver those products to the people in a very powerful position. With Battle, it was gambling. It was the simple game of bolita, betting the number, that he organized in such a way that people were able to do it on a daily basis and enjoyed doing it and became addicted to it, I guess, as you do with any form of gambling. So I guess you could say this organization preyed on the addictions, the gambling addictions of people. But generally within the community, it was seen as a benign form of criminal activity, a victimless crime, really. And that's partly why law enforcement didn't really take it seriously.
I wonder, you know, I couldn't help but think this is a time when, you know, we're speaking now after James Comey has come out with his book in which he said that, you know, our president, President Trump, reminded him more than anything of a mob boss. And in many ways, your picture of Jose Miguel Battle also reminded me of our president, you know, maybe sans the assassinations. You say that if you don't understand the history of organized crime in America, you don't understand America. And now we've been talking about the underworld and the upper world. I guess as a final thing, what's your thought about this as part of the cultural, DNA of our country?
Well, it has to do with American capitalism. I mean, you ask any mobster, gangster, and I've interviewed quite a few of them in all different ethnicities. Ask them what they do for a living, and they'll tell you they're a businessman, and that's how they see themselves. And, you know, this brings us back to our president, who started out as a businessman. The ruthless tactics of American enterprise. This is rooted very deeply in the American story. I mean, if we begin with the eradication of the indigenous population through violence, if we start with a system of economics based on slavery that was eventually declared to be illegal, we see that the roots of this country are all tangled up in violence, aggression as a form of social advancement, a system that is part and parcel of a lot of these brutal, violent tactics. You know, I know this is something that the average American maybe doesn't want to hear and gets their back up to hear it defined this way, but I would say ask yourself why this type of organized crime and this mentality that makes organized crime possible has been so persistent in American history and continues to this day, even though it's gone through many different variations. You know, it used to be all about illegal alcohol. It used to be labor racketeering. Now it's narcotics. The rackets have changed, but the mentality remains the same. You can go to any American city, not just the big ones, even mid-sized ones, pick up a local newspaper, local media, and I will bet you somewhere there's an article about a local congressman who was recently indicted for taking kickbacks from some criminal organization so that they could have a law passed or they could get a contract. It's just part of the way business has been done in the United States of America. And I do believe the popularity of the current president for some people was that he inhabited that mentality. And they see that as admirable in some way, a tough businessman who's going to advocate for the interests of his followers. So these are things that are very deeply rooted in the American experience. And I find it fascinating, and it's one of the reasons I find writing about organized crime so interesting, because you do wind up writing about politics and sociology and economics and pretty much everything.
And it's all in the name of your book, as well as this organization, The Corporation.
Yes. Yeah, that term was chosen for a very specific reason, I believe. You know, there's nothing more capitalistic than a corporation. It is the definition of a capitalist enterprise. And this generation of Cubans, who had been chased out of their home by a communist revolution, embraced capitalism quite aggressively. And I think they knew what they were doing when they called themselves the corporation. This was the farthest thing from communism that it could be. It was with a certain purpose that they were asserting themselves as a capitalist undertaking by calling themselves the corporation.
Well, it's an absolutely terrific book. It is a page-turner par excellence. And TJ English, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about The Corporation.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
TJ English is an author and journalist whose work chronicles the American underworld. He's the author of 8 books, including Savage City, Havana Nocturne, and now his latest, The Corporation. Stay tuned after the break for an extended clip from our 2008 interview with TJ English about his book, Havana Nocturne. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you don't understand the history of organized crime in America, you don't understand America. That's what TJ English wrote in his latest book, The Corporation, an epic story of the Cuban-American underworld. It's an idea he broached in his earlier book, Havana Nocturne, how the mob owned Cuba and then lost it to the revolution. He told us about that book in 2008. Here's an excerpt from that interview, exploring that idea in more depth. The clip starts out with me asking T.J. English about Meyer Lansky, who played a central role in bringing the mafia to Cuba under Batista, the dictator overthrown by Fidel Castro in 1959.
Yeah, Lansky is the architect of the plan that the mob had for Cuba, and he was the one that initially formed the relationship with Batista that made it all possible. Way back in the early 1930s, we don't know exactly why or how this came about, but Lansky set his sights on Batista. Batista rose to be the head of the Cuban military in 1933 at the young age of 32. And it was then that Lansky made a trip to Havana and paid a cash bribe in cash. We know this from an associate of Lansky's who described it in one of Lansky's biographies. He claims to have accompanied Lansky when they delivered a suitcase filled with cash to Batista in 1933. This was a bribe. In a way, it was Lansky making an investment in Batista at a very early stage, designating Batista as the likely power in Cuba for a generation to come. And it was a smart bet. It would take decades for it to pay off because historical events kept getting in the way. But it turned out to be the key relationship that made everything possible. And Lansky's a fascinating character. He, unlike a lot of mobsters, gangsters in the history of the American underworld, he kind of saw himself as a legitimate businessman. He was not a man of violence or not someone who committed violence with his own hands, although that's not meant to exonerate him. I'm sure Meyer Lansky was in on the decision-making process that led to a lot of mob assassinations over the years. But for the most part, in his own personal and business life, he stayed above the fray. He interacted with politicians and other so-called legitimate businessmen, and that was the world that he preferred to circulate in. And so he also was very adept at making money for his partners. That was the key. That's why Lansky lived, unlike a lot of mobsters who wind up in prison or taken out in getting whacked, taken out in some kind of a mob hit. Lansky lived long enough to die of old age, and a lot of that was simply the fact that he made money for a lot of people over the years.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with T.J. English about his book Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. Well, you point out how he was, you know, he was the businessman, he was the rationalist, mm-hmm. the architect here. I found that one of the most interesting ideas in your book, and it made me think back to when The Godfather came out, the movie The Godfather, or the three movies The Godfather, and how I was impressed at that time with how the mob seemed to be a version of capitalism, kind of the underbelly perhaps, but really not that much different than any other corporation, except in the fact that it was illegal and directly murdered a lot of people.
Right, yes, you're right. And I think perhaps we've lost sight of this in a way. Historically speaking, we forget how powerful the American underworld became, basically from the years of the 1920s when Prohibition gave birth to organized crime as we would come to know it, created this massive framework of crime, created a criminal structure in which the money from booze, in the case of Prohibition, but in later decades also from gambling and narcotics, would be used to influence the political system to corrupt law enforcement. This is the modus operandi of organized crime in the United States that existed for many, many decades, from the 20s right up until the 1990s. And in these years of the 40s and 50s, with people like Lansky and Frank Costello and Lucky Luciano and others, the mob came to see themselves as a budding multinational corporation. That's really how they saw themselves, and they envisioned that there would come a time when they would have the power to influence elections. And that's part of what this operation in Cuba was all about, because Cuba was supposed to be merely the stepping stone, the first step in a kind of international framework where the mob would establish a base of economic power in places like the Caribbean and in South America and possibly in Europe. They would do it through the leisure industry, through casino gambling and things related to that. This would create incredible wealth that they could then use to influence the political structure. And yes, it was kind of grand, very grandiose in scope, and it was modeled basically on American corporate structure. Lansky and the others saw themselves as CEOs of a national corporation, and ultimately, hopefully for them, a multinational corporation. In fact, you know, there was a period in the American underworld where there was a violent separation between the new generation, the people like Lansky and Luciano, taking out the old world mobsters with roots in Sicily, kind of the more traditional mafia, Cosa Nostra, connected to the old country based on sort of a village mentality. No, the American version was to be a major corporation, and the heads of the mob were to be like CEOs. So it was the taking of American capitalism and adapting it to the underworld marketplace.
Well, maybe that new mob has now become, much, much diminished in size. But you've looked at other crime syndicates also. You've written about the Vietnamese. So do you think that this model of kind of the underworld, this shadow capitalism, is one that is still vital today and still kind of interpenetrates into the more legitimate power?
Yeah, there's been books written about this. I think a lot of the, in the upper reaches of the underworld, the level at which organized crime has influence over laws and banking and all that kind of stuff, that to a large extent has been subsumed into the corporate, so-called legitimate corporate structure. And in fact, many of what were criminal rackets in the 30s and 40s and 50s are now controlled in some way by the corporate world or by the government. I could go down a laundry list of things.
Yeah, give us an example.
Well, when you were in the 30s and 40s, if you were someone who didn't have lived in a neighborhood and you were of not great means and you needed some quick money, you went to a loan shark. Well, now you have a credit card. You go to the bank. The numbers racket, for instance, what they called the policy rackets, you wanted to play the number, bet on the number, you would do that with a local policy boss. Now you do it through the state lottery. The state government controls that. Narcotics, if you wanted to get high, if you wanted to soften the edges in your life, you would smoke a joint, do some heroin, buy some coke. Now America is hooked on pharmaceuticals so that they get prescribed to them by the doctor, and the medical system and the government gets their piece of it. I would argue that many of the types of behavior that we used to designate as criminal activity when it was controlled by the criminals has now been legalized in some form or another and is regulated by the government and by private industry, and they are the ones that make the profit. So in the larger framework of corporate activity, I mean, this gets into a whole area of the degree to which corporations control the world economy in ways that the mob might have dreamed of. So in many ways, a lot of the activities of the underworld during what they call the glory years of the underworld, the 30s, 40s, and 50s, have now just kind of integrated themselves into the so-called legitimate world.
Well, and now back to Cuba. Of course, part of the story, a very large part of the story, is not only what happened to, not only what the mob did in taking over Cuba, but also how the mob got overthrown in Cuba, the
right.
Rise of the revolution. First, I'd like to ask you, is there a connection? Was there a way in which the control by Fulgencio Batista and the mob of Cuba actually heightened the contradictions that brought about the revolution?
Yes, I think so, exactly. And that was one of the most fascinating things to me about researching this book, and one of the reasons for doing this book, because it occurred to me, you know, that there have been many books and studies of the Cuban Revolution, and there have been some things written about the mob in Cuba during these years, not much, But it always astounded me that these things were the mob's exploitation of Havana and the revolution were unfolding at the same time, and yet historically we've always treated them as if they were sort of separate and unrelated events. And so part of the motivation of this book was to find the ways in which they fueled and influenced each other. And in fact, these two parallel stories are sort of unfolding on parallel tracks. You have the mob creating this empire in Cuba, in Havana, very specifically in Havana, while at the same time around the island, mostly outside of Havana, the revolution is brewing and gaining strength. And yes, I do believe that, you know, the Cuban Revolution, though it's a very complex event and is deeply rooted in Cuban history, it is true that the exploitation of Havana, what was taking the plundering of Havana, the turning Havana into one big bordello, as Castro sometimes referred to it, became a very powerful motivating symbol for the revolution. There's no question about that. It came to represent a kind of capitalistic plundering of the island that the Cuban people had come to resent over the many generations. And you see this in a lot of the literature of the revolution and the communications of the revolution through rebel radio and everything, the references to what was taking place in Havana, particularly the relationship between the mobsters and the corrupt Batista regime and the American corporate interests, who were also benefiting from this tourism boom that was taking place, this mob-generated tourism boom. To the revolution, it seemed as though it was these three forces, the corrupt politicians, the mobsters, and the U.S. corporations, were all one entity, that they were all in it together.
The United Fruit Company organized tourist junkets going down there. Was that right? Or Pan American Airlines? But
yes.
Wasn't United Fruit in on
Well, United Fruit was a power in Cuba throughout the 20th century, a power in Cuba and in Latin America. They owned the sugar plantations, controlled the sugar business. Pan Am was part owner of the most glorious hotel in Havana, the Nacional. And inside of the Nacional, you had a casino owned and operated by the Lansky brothers, Meyer Lansky and his brother Jake. So, you know, these are all examples of ways in which it seemed as though the American corporate interest and the mobsters were kind of benefiting each other in Havana.
You call it an odd quirk of history that the two most powerful forces behind the Havana mob, and that was Meyer Lansky and Fulgencio Batista, were born into dire poverty. Yet the man who brought them down, Fidel, was born into wealth. Is there anything beyond just coincidence in this?
Well, it is a fact that you find throughout history often enough that the revolutions that are waged on behalf of the people, the working class, the proletariat, are often organized and orchestrated by people from the educated class, from the bourgeoisie. And so that was certainly the case in Cuba. Castro, who had been born into wealth and lived a kind of life of privilege, became this advocate for the downtrodden in Cuba, whereas Batista and Lansky, who came from the downtrodden, came from poverty, became the protectors of the bourgeoisie in Cuba. It is interesting, and it's a dynamic you see in other instances in history of revolution. So,
what do you make of that?
Well, the only thing I can say is to create a kind of revolutionary fervor and to have the far-reaching sense of linking your revolutionary movement to historical precedent takes at least some people, someone, some leader with some kind of great historical background and sense, in other words, education. The thing about Castro was not only was he sort of have all these dynamic personal attributes, charisma, dynamic speaker, he was an intellectual. He'd done a lot of reading. He did his reading and most of it in prison while he was in prison, but he had an incredible wealth of knowledge, historical knowledge, philosophical knowledge, political knowledge. So it was that vision that you have to come from a kind of educated background to have a vision like that. Someone from that kind of background often winds up being in the leadership role of a revolution.
And what about the other side of that? the Meyer Lansky's.
I think part of coming from that level of poverty is and Lansky said this in an interview once, that he vowed that he would never live in that kind of poverty again, and the whole purpose of his life became to acquire wealth, like a kind of wealth that he never had in his childhood. You know, the curious thing about Lansky is they said he would come to Cuba during these years, you know, the tourist season in the winter. Our winter was the big time of year in Havana, and that's when the Lansky would come down there for the tourist season, and that he and the other mobsters took no interest in the poverty or the economic disparity in Havana, except as it related to the revolution, which was a threat possibly to their operations. But other than that, they had no interest. They had no social consciousness about the disparity of wealth in Cuba. They were there as predatory capitalists to make a buck, and they saw Cuba as a place to do that. And that became their Achilles heel, in a way. Their inability to recognize that and to have a consciousness about that made it so that they didn't really see what was happening until the revolution was right in their lap.
T.J. English talking with Writer's Voice in 2008 about his book Havana Nocturne. If you came in late on this episode of Writer's Voice, in the first part of today's show, we spoke with T.J. English about what you could call the sequel, his new book, The Corporation. You can hear the entire interview about Havana Nocturne at writersvoice.net, and you can also find a link to our interview with him about his book, Savage City. And in the minute we have left, two summer reading picks. We've had writer Lionel Shriver on Writer's Voice several times in the past, always about a novel she's just written. This time she's come out with a collection of short stories and two novellas called Property. Shriver is an intellectual writer. She likes to sink her teeth into an idea. Health insurance, for example, or what happens when the world goes dark to electronic devices. These stories in Property are no exception. They explore the idea of how property acts as proxies for ourselves, whether it be in real estate or just stuff. And here's a novel we'll be following up on in the fall, but you can get a jump on that conversation by checking it out now. The novel is The Removes by Tatiana Soli. We first spoke with her too many years ago about her debut novel, The Lotus Eaters. Her latest, The Removes, takes the reader to the American West during Custer's time. In fact, Custer is a character, along with two young women. One is a teenager who's captured by Cheyenne warriors and joins the tribe. The other is Custer's wife. All three characters have to wrestle with their role in the conquest of the American West and the dispossession of its native inhabitants. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.